Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
So my name is Hamilton Fish, and I'm the publisher of the New Republic magazine, and this is our first trip to the Bay Area Book Festival. Give yourselves a big hand. This is a fantastic event. We're really excited to be a part of this rapidly growing celebration of culture and ideas, and to build the magazine's presence here in Northern California. And of course, I'd be remiss if I failed to invite you to fill out the subscription cards found in your tote bags, where big discounts await. Let me just say how thrilled we are at the New Republic to have the opportunity to sponsor this afternoon's conversation. To our admiring editors, Roxane Gay is one of the most gifted, socially tuned, and important voices in contemporary American fiction. And Rafia Zakaria, in addition to being a respected social historian and critic, is also a valued contributor to the pages of our magazine. As most of you in today's audience will know, Roxane Gay is a feminist writer, professor, editor, and commentator. She's an associate professor of English at Purdue University, which I would say may give new meaning, perhaps, to Boilermakers, the nickname commonly attached to students and athletic teams at Purdue, and one that might now also be extended to include the blast furnaces of her indelible prose. She's a contributing opinion writer at the New York Times, founder of Tiny Hardcore Press, essays editor for The Rumpus, and co-editor of Pank, a nonprofit literary arts collective. She is perhaps best known for her New York Times best-selling collection of essays, Bad Feminist. She's also the author of the short story collection, Aiti, the novel, An Untamed State, the short story collection, Difficult Women, and the forthcoming Hunger, which is something of a mystery, which maybe you could ask her about. Rafia Zakaria is an attorney, a political philosopher, and the author of the highly regarded memoir, The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan. She is also, as I mentioned, a contributor at The New Republic. And this excerpt is from her recent essay in The New Republic on difficult women, titled Roxane Gay's Masterpieces of Private Rage. The protagonists of her stories are not always black or brown, nor always women, but they are, all of them, complicit in the infliction or perpetration of intimate violence, racked by secret desires and seething rage. All of it deftly and terrifyingly underscores the absurdity of a society tacitly ordered by skin color and the privileges accrued by those who have ended up at the winning end, circled and watched by those who have not. Please join me in welcoming to the stage of the Bay Area Book Festival, Roxane Gay and Rafia Zakaria.
Hello, everybody. Well, this is the greatest moment of my life. it's great being close to greatness because I know Roxane speaks to packed houses all the time. I speak to 20 or 30 people at best, so this is a huge honor for me. I'm very grateful to the New Republic, to Mr. Fish, to my editor, Laura Marsh, to Evelyn and Eliza, who put it all together, and of course, to Roxane Gay for being here today and speaking with us. We, as all of you know, are living in times of crisis. You know, just this week and last week, we don't have to look far for the evidence of the devastation that is in play. Last week, two girls in a train in Portland were being harassed, and the men who came to their assistance were killed. Both were dark-skinned, one was wearing a hijab. Same week, University of Maryland, a white student attacked and stabbed a black student. This week, a noose was found at the African American Museum in Washington, D.C., in the exhibit for segregation. This morning, I turned on the TV to see LeBron James talk about the racial slur that was spray-painted on the wall of his Brentwood home. So I don't have to underscore how difficult it is to be anything but white in America right now. In terms of numbers, as a Muslim American, I have to add that there's been a 67% increase in hate crimes against Muslim Americans. But when you look at our institutions, for instance, those numbers are not counted. So I looked today at a report in Slate magazine in which there's one report from the U.S. Justice Department that says that there are about 280,000 hate crimes every year in the U.S. But if you look at the FBI numbers, they say there are only 6,000 to 10,000 hate crimes in the U.S. So those are the numbers, and that is the disparity with which I want to begin our conversation today. As we all know, Ms. Gay has been an incredible spokesperson on these issues. And her voice, I actually listened to your interview. You gave an interview to Kamau Bell the morning after the election. And that was my one solace. That was the only time I felt that the devastation and anger that I was feeling was reflected in public conversation. So my first question to you is, what does this do in terms of the visibility of hatred in our society? The fact that we see it all the time, it's happening every week, but our institutions fail to count it, they fail to report it, and they fail to prosecute it. How do you see the future of that disparity and that conversation in the America that we live in today?
I have no idea. The disparity is grotesque. And every day, multiple times a day, we hear stories of just how bad it is. And people still resist. And so I think one of the first things is that we can't count on institutions for anything, especially not under this president. We can call him the president, but let's be real. He can't even spell it. So, I think that we have to find ways to support each other and get justice for hate crimes and this kind of violence outside of the institutions, because the FBI does not care. And they're not going to care until... I don't know what it's going to take. After Sandy Hook, I stopped believing in institutions. I just did. Because if the murder of children was not the bar in this country for changing the discourse around violence, let alone gun violence, then nothing was going to change it. And every single day something new happens. Like now these young men in Portland were killed. And that's not going to move the needle either. Nothing is going to move the needle. And so I think, I hate to sound so depressing, but I think that we have to find ways to exist without the institutions and survive and thrive without the institutions. And we have to think about other forms of justice outside of the carceral system, which actually does not often provide justice.
So in the same interview with Kumar Bell that I've listened to it several times. So, hey, sorry. I know
it's okay.
I know
I
parts
have
of it. My heart. Well, one of the most interesting things or most valuable things in terms of resistance beyond institutions that you mentioned is that you don't like the term white allies. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, increasingly, I'm just done with allyship, because when you call yourself an ally, you are creating a remove between you and the problem. And I think that we have to start taking on oppression individually as if it is our own oppression, because that's the only time we are invested enough to do what it takes to create actual change. And I think white people in particular love this idea of allyship and of like being a good white person. Not an event goes by where a white person does not stand up in the audience and ask me, what can I do? That is a prime example of white allyship. Like waiting for us to provide emotional labor to teach you how to be a decent human being. And it's frustrating. Like, it's common sense. I don't have the answers. People of color don't have a magical treasure trove of wisdom from which we draw. And so it's exhausting to be asked this question. And until people are willing to abandon this idea of allyship and say, you know what, transgender oppression is my own, and racial oppression is my own, and the oppression that we see against disability and different kinds of bodies is my own, we're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, I love it. One of the other things that you've talked about, and I think you're very in your new book, which, hey guys, this comes out next week, and oh my god, I was telling everyone I have a very very coveted secret copy, and I'm gonna run back to my hotel room and hide it as soon as this is over, because after this conversation, you're not gonna be able to wait to read this. Seriously speaking, though, in this book and in so much of your written work and your commentary, you are very honest about your own privilege. The fact that you don't share all the variables with every oppressed person, with every person who's facing an injustice. Would you talk a little bit about the moral responsibility of privilege and what that entails for individuals?
Yeah, definitely. When I wrote Bad Feminist, I wrote an essay about privilege, and I was really thinking about how all too often when we're having discussions about oppression and creating social change, people love to use the idea of privilege as a weapon to silence. And, you know, people say, oh, you know, you're a white man, shut up. Which oftentimes is the best advice, but is that really productive? Are we really being genuine with that? And I think that oftentimes when you are marginalized, there is this posturing as if you have no privilege. And within the developed world, at least, I think almost everybody has some kind of privilege. And it's important to acknowledge that privilege, because you can both have privilege and be oppressed. Those are things that are not antithetical. And so I am very open about the fact that I have many privileges, because I think it's important for you to understand that oftentimes when I'm talking about social justice, I'm not crying and whining, and I'm not talking about things that I don't have. I'm thinking about something bigger than myself, and I'm thinking about this idea of the greater good, and that when you have a voice, you have a responsibility to use it for people not just like you. And so the older I get and the more mature I get, the more I try to do that, because it's just so, so important. Yep.
I mean, to what extent, though? I mean, I'm going to push you a little bit on that, because I think that sometimes when we talk about that within abstract discussions, In fact, it reminds me of one of the incidences that you talk about in your new book, which is when you got your acceptance letter to Yale. Mm-hmm. And there was a white male student who saw you open your letter and that you got it, and he immediately said, affirmative action. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that, because I think that the power of that incident and the power of what you say, I think people perhaps don't understand how the abstract discussion of privilege translates into things they say and do and feel and judge every day.
Yeah, I mean, within the thing is, like, the reason I think it's important to locate your own privilege is that we were in the post office of Phillips Exeter Academy. Where I went to high school. And I was holding an acceptance letter to Yale. And he was like, wah, affirmative action. And so he went to, like, BU. I'm going to hell. And I went to Yale.
And we're all going with you.
Yes.
We're coming.
Like, yes, he has more privilege, absolutely, and he is very irresponsible with his privilege, but don't cry for me. Like, that was, like, the best possible circumstance under which I could be oppressed. I talk about it, and it affected me, and it's certainly, when I write about my ambition, I talk about how no matter where I am and what I achieve, there are white people telling me that I'm there because of affirmative action. But, like, you can't cry for me. I just think it's indicative of how pervasive oppression is that you never get any credit for your accomplishments no matter what you're doing. So I just like to complicate the conversation a little bit more and say there's some context here in that, yes, we can look at this situation and say he's the bad guy, because he is. He played lacrosse. So, but... there are levels to it, as the kids say.
Yeah. Well, going from our laughter to the issue of rage.
Yes.
And anger. You wrote for the New York Times a fantastic essay called Who Gets to Be Angry?
Oh, I like that one.
I know. I've read that a few times, too. I think that... one of the things that you identify in that essay is this disparity between who is permitted to have public anger. And I think that people forget that. People forget that when you or I or a person of color or a person who's disabled walk into a room, all the prejudices or all the interactions that people in the room have ever had with a person of that type walk in with them. Mm-hmm. And so they have this burden that they have to disprove. And that plays out very crucially in terms of anger and rage. So maybe talk a little bit about the difference between the two and this issue of
between anger and rage?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think anger is more focused. And rage is broader, because rage is collective. It's accumulated. And a lot of us right now are experiencing both anger and rage. You know, I'm angry about the election, but I feel rage about all the reasons why the election went the way it did. And so it's important to understand that distinction, but I also think it's important to embrace anger and rage, because all too often when people are angry or rageful, they're dismissed as if you cannot be rational of thought and you can't make sense and be angry. And as if anger is an inappropriate emotion given the things that are going on in this world. It's very appropriate. It's a question of, like, what you do with that anger. And I try not to judge people for what they do with their anger, because sometimes anger is unproductive, sometimes it is productive, and sometimes it accumulates to such an extent that you are full of rage. And I am very comfortable with rage. I am, and I feel quite a lot of it. And yet I'm still able to function in society. It's amazing.
But what was that process? Because you didn't obviously, you didn't get to hear, and without confronting situations in which you were told to calm down,
mm-hmm.
or you were looked at as, oh, you know, we can't listen to anything. She's obviously yeah. now left the realm of our rational discussion. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what the process was because I think I'm still in it. I think whenever I am dismissed because of my anger, I just recognize that that is not someone who was ever going to listen to what I had to say anyway. It's people who don't want to do anything. They don't want to have they don't want to invest the energy in thinking and being critical in their thinking. So they say, oh, you're angry, which means I'm tired and lazy. Don't bother me with whatever it is that you're going to go on about. And that's fine. And so part of the process in being comfortable with anger and rage has just been to understand where a lot of the dismissal of anger and rage come from. A lot of it comes from laziness. Some of it comes from fear. And some of it comes from ignorance. And I try to determine on a case-by-case basis if I should respond or if I just walk away. And it really just depends on a case-by-case basis and whether I think that person is reachable. If they're not reachable, I'm just like, well, do you.
I love it. I love it. So, and going along with that, I think, and actually... Ham quoted part of that essay that I wrote on difficult women.
Which was very lovely, by the way.
Thank you. This is my dream moment come true. Everybody, did you hear that? But I think what was particularly poignant and very masterfully done in that essay is that you showed how both racism and anger seep into the private lives of people, and how they get translated into these interactions that are not public interactions. So the interaction between couples, the interactions between someone who cleans people's houses and the aerobics instructor and her students in a rich Florida subdivision. Now you've been on book tour for Difficult Women for several months, and I'm just curious as to what reception you have had and what sort of questions you've received, and whether some of those undercurrents have been seen by people.
The reception overall has been very good and very gratifying. In the early going, there were a lot of people who were like, oh, but what about the men? And I was like, what about them? The book is called Difficult Women. I write for women. I'm not worried about the men. And they would, like, more than one radio interviewer said, shouldn't this book be called Difficult Men? And those are people that...
What do you say to that?
I said, no. Like, I just... I'm so tired. I feel like I've lost all fucks. I'm just like, no. I don't give a damn if you have me back on your radio show or not. No. Those are the people, I think, that didn't see the nuance of the stories and didn't see that a lot of what was fueling the stories and fueling the motivations of the characters I write about was rage. And that's okay, because there are levels to this shit. And so there are some people who read the surface of the story and think, oh, it's just a story about a relationship gone bad, or it's a story of a wealthy community. But, you know, in the story Florida in particular, it's also about the people that make that community possible. And the people who do a lot of the invisible labor in that community. And so when people get that and when people see that, that makes me very happy. And so I have enjoyed those moments. Unfortunately, a lot of people stop at, oh, there are so many bad men in this book. And that's not true. There are several good men. I have male friends. and... That's not the point. The point is that oftentimes women deal with a lot of nonsense. And so in a collection with this many stories, like, yeah, 80% of them are going to have women dealing with nonsense. That's just reflective of life. And I'm fine. You know, that I just take a lot of that criticism in stride, and it is what it is, but I will write the same damn story over and over again. I found my story. I love it.
Well, so that's your last book. We'll move on to your next book.
Yes.
A book which I quote, you know, in the beginning of this book, you say, writing this book is a confession. These are the weakest, barest parts. These are the ugliest, weakest, barest parts of me. So you've moved, obviously, from fiction now to memoir. And it is just the most staggeringly honest book that I have read. Every writer aims to do that with their words, but you've done it. But at the same time, as you yourself say, it is a very personal book. How are you feeling, this weekend, before this, you know? Where are you at?
Oh, I'm feeling a lot of existential dread. I always swore I would never write a memoir.
I mean, it is just beautiful.
And, thank you.
And I mean, you know, but you can, you have shown, I mean, it's transformative, and you can see the journey that you've been on, mm-hmm. In this book. And so, I'm just, I guess, curious just in terms of this book. And even, you know, you've written very personal essays before, mm-hmm. so it's obviously not uncharted territory for you. In terms of how you make sense as a writer of showing your most intimate parts to your readers, and also how you are negotiating your public and private self. I mean, how do you think of those things?
Well, I have very clear boundaries with myself about what I will and won't write about. And I stick to those boundaries without exception, because I think that all too often we ask writers, and women in particular, to bear themselves entirely and to sacrifice themselves for someone's reading pleasure or delectation. And I don't want to be sort of subjected to that, even though I don't get to control how people read my book. So I had firm boundaries and I stuck to them. And, you know, I didn't want to necessarily write this book at all, but I was thinking about what my next nonfiction book was going to be. I actually sold this in June or July 2014, right before Bad Feminist came out. I should have waited. But that's okay.
It's going to do great.
Yeah, I think it's going to work out for me. Don't cry.
It is. Again. No, I'm not. In fact, I'm like, hey, I'll just come right with you.
So it'll be fun. But I was thinking about what is the book I want to write least? And I thought that writing a book about fatness was the book I really wanted to write the very least. And that's how I knew it was the book that I needed to write the most. And so I decided, okay, well, we're going to have a growth opportunity here.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that's what I wrote.
Yeah, and, you know, in one of your talks, I remember said, after Bad Feminist, it's, I want people to have a little bit of bravery. But, I mean, you've shown us so much bravery.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yes. And so, we still have time. I was wondering if you would want to read a little from it, maybe?
Sure.
we'll get you warmed up for your book tour.
I'm glad you have a copy. I didn't even like, I know, I didn't bring a copy on this trip. I've been traveling so much. I just got back from Australia and I went home for like 2 nights and I threw my shit in my suitcase on Thursday to come here. And I was like, whatever happens, happens with whatever's in this suitcase right now. And so I didn't bring a book. I didn't bring a piece of paper. I don't know what I was thinking, but I'm glad you have a copy. Okay, I can read the last paragraph. That's fine. Yes. Writing this book is the most difficult thing I've ever done. To lay myself so vulnerable has not been an easy thing. To face myself and what living in my body has been like has not been an easy thing. But I wrote this book because it felt necessary. In writing this memoir of my body and telling you these truths about my body, I am sharing my truth and mine alone. I understand if that truth is not something you want to hear. The truth makes me uncomfortable too. But I am also saying, here is my heart, what's left of it. Here I am showing you the ferocity of my hunger. Here I am finally freeing myself to be vulnerable and terribly human. Here I am reveling in that freedom. Here, see what I hunger for and what my truth has allowed me to create. It's a decent book. I'm actually really struggling because it's so personal and makes me so uncomfortable, and I'm, you know, a work in progress, and I got such a bad review, and I was just like, oh, what the fuck? She was like, the reviewer was like, parts of it read like a celebrity gossip memoir, and I was just like, what? That, like, did you read the book I wrote? Because there are plenty of things that you can critique, and I'm actually, you know, I have a good sense of what the criticisms are going to be, but that was not like, that wasn't on the radar. So that was a new one. I'm very upset about it.
Well, I think you're going to get some very stunning reviews, but...
Oh, thank you.
I need at least one. But in terms of doing that, in terms of navigating, I mean, it's this book, of course, it's about you, but it also involves in greater role your parents.
Yes.
And I think as someone who's written memoir myself, for me, that is always the hardest thing, because our relationships with our parents are inevitably multidimensional. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about that and how you've sort of thought about that as you were mm-hmm. writing this.
Yeah, one of my clearest boundaries is to be very judicious in terms of how I write about the people in my life, whether it's my parents or my partner, because the people in my life don't ask for all of this. And there's nothing that's happened in my life that I feel such a burning desire to write about that I would transgress their boundaries. But at the same time, in writing about my body, I have to write about my parents. And so I would try to be as... I love my parents. We hang out. They call every day. It's Haitian parents never let go. So we get along very, very well. But there's also a lot of rage there. Because I was a skinny child. And then I was assaulted when I was 12. And then I gained a ton of weight. And I continued gaining. And so they saw weight as a problem to solve. And so they put me on a liquid diet, and then I went to fat camp. I mean, like, and just crazy shit to do to a child. And I know that it came from a good place, but at the same time, it did some pretty harmful things to me in terms of how I see myself and my level of comfort around other human beings and my family in particular. And so I had to write about that. And so I tried to be as kind as I could to them. And I was very, very kind, I feel. But also...
You are.
Thank you,
are
right?
Like, kind.
And I also...
Because at one of the episodes, when you went to the one camp where you just... The food was... And you had to climb up the hill to go back to your cabin every time. I'm thinking,
so
my God.
Bad. It was called Camp Kingsmont. And it was, like, outdoorsy. And that's not me. That's never been me. I'm more like the girl who would go to chess camp. And so we had to walk up this huge hill to get to the cabin. And so if you forgot something in your cabin, you either were shit out of luck or you were shit out of luck because you had to go get it. And I get why the cabins were at the top of this mountain. But I'm not a mountaineer. So it was just not great. And so I talk about a lot of that stuff. And it's just, I just had to tell the story. And I told them not to read the book. And I've had varying degrees of success with that in my past books. I told my mom not to read Bad Feminist. I also told my dad. My mom listened. She still hasn't read it, but my dad read it from cover to cover. And then we had a conversation about it.
Oh, no.
It was good. My dad's my number one fan. But I hope they don't read this book. But there's nothing in there they can't read. No. I just don't want to sit down and chat with them about it now.
So as one of the last questions, I think one of the central dilemmas of this book that is conveyed very, very, in a very accessible and lyrical way is what can and can't be done to help someone, the 12-year-old Roxanne, who was in such large amounts of pain and was so alone. And even in a sense, you can weigh the sort of helplessness of your parents who love this child more than anything and yet are sort of unable, you know, to really reach you. That's my last question from this set is what you heard.
I don't know. I think about that a lot. And the reality is that I was 12 and I was very scared and I was very sheltered. And so I thought, I'm going to hell. I was just convinced because my parents are super Catholics. And I don't know what they could have done, because when they found out, when Bad Feminist came out, they were like, oh, we would have done something. And I'm like, of course, I know that now. But at 12, I did not know that. And my parents were good parents who, you know, we had an open family. We could talk about pretty much anything. And so I don't know that there's a mode of parenting that would have made me comfortable with saying, hey, this terrible thing happened to me. I need help. And they knew something was wrong. They just didn't know what. And they just saw this symptom, this weight gain happening. So I don't know. But I do know that for other 12-year-olds, I mean, you have to be paying attention. And I think you also have to figure out what the right questions are to ask your child without being an interrogator.
Yeah.
And it's really a difficult thing. Like, how do you get kids to talk about sexual violence? I think we've come a long way. I was born in 1974. It's a much different world now than it was in 1986. It's just a much different world.
Okay, I actually do have one last question.
I'm here for you.
Of course. And that is one of the something that I haven't heard in other discussions or even other memoirs that talk about sexual violence is, you know, you say you accept the term victim and you don't reject it and you distinguish between victim and survivor. And talk, I think, about why we need to preserve the idea of a victim.
I'm fine with the label victim because I know that it's not the singular definition of who I am. And for me, what I feel the word does, it allows there to be an acknowledgement that something terrible happened, that I suffered. And I'm fine with the term survivor as well, but the term survivor, and I understand why many people use it, and I don't
because
have
it's
any
a triumphal
issue. Yeah, it's,
yes,
it's exactly
arc, right,
and it's this idea that I overcame, and I don't know that I'll ever overcome. You know, I don't know that that narrative arc is open to me for whatever reason, and I'm just old enough to no longer care about that kind of resolution, and so I embrace victim as much as I embrace survivor, because I survived, I'm still alive, yay. But I also I think that it's I don't mind acknowledging that suffering happened. It's not, and again, that it's not the singular thing about me. It, at this point in my life, it's one of the least interesting things about me. But I like sometimes to call things what they are.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're going to take questions.
Yeah, we have until like 4:30, whatever time it is now.
We're told to keep time for questions. So.
Yeah.
You know, I think we did plan to open the conversation to people in the audience. So if you just raise your hand and we'll try to do it in an orderly way. I would just like to use the prerogative and ask a question quickly, which... relates to everything that you've just said, which is out of ignorance on my part. Did your parents know about the assault?
No. They found out when Bad Feminist came out.
So I think that it puts all of your descriptions of childhood and the admiration you have for your parents in a really remarkable light.
I think so too. No. Yeah. Thank you.
So just raise a hand and where are we?
Yep. And just make sure your question is a question and not a blog post.
Yes.
Yes, there's a woman in a blue t-shirt. Oh, I guess there are two women in blue t-shirts. What are the chances? Sorry about that. Both of you will get to ask.
My t-shirt is not blue, but anyway. I'm in... So all of your characters are just incredible. I mean, they're just so full. And there were times, like when I would read something that you wrote, and I would just sort of fall backward and just say... That's like the perfect paragraph or the perfect... How do you feel when you read something that you've written like that? Does that just blow you away too? Or how
does
that...
it does. I feel the exact same way. You know, it really depends, but I'm actually not an angsty writer. I enjoy writing. I don't have low self-esteem about my writing. But I also, I don't think I'm the greatest writer ever. I just write the stories that I truly enjoy reading. And it works for me. It doesn't work for everyone. But when I write a story and I read it and I feel affected by it, that's when I know it's the right story. If I've written something and I'm just that's how I know it's not ready yet. And it needs to percolate a little bit more. But it really depends. But I oftentimes, when I write a good paragraph, I just feel tingly. I feel this rush of energy just beneath my skin. And that's how I know. And I try to recreate that with every single line in a story. That's a lot of my process right there. All right, other blue t-shirt lady.
So I haven't read much of your stuff, so I apologize if this is in there somewhere, but are you able to stay hopeful with the anger and rage? And if so, how do you do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, I am able to stay hopeful because otherwise the alternative is too grim for me. But it's challenging. I don't know. I just... still try and have hope. And it's been very, very hard for me personally since November because I'm still staggered. I can believe it because I live part-time in Indiana, but I can't believe it because I live part-time in LA. It's what? How did this happen? But if we don't have hope, then what are we fighting for? And what are we telling younger generations? We've ridden this horse, but we're going to kill it now. You don't get a ride. And I just think that's really unfair. I think that we have to think about just the state of the world and what we want for that world. And I think we have to wish hope into it in order for hope to be even a possibility. Oh, you don't have to clap.
No, I was going to press you on Indiana and LA and those very different contexts. Mm-hmm. And, I went to IU Bloomington for my graduate work, and I would still say that driving through most of the post-industrial towns in Indiana, whether it's Gary or Marion or Muncie, you see a different sort of anger and a different mm-hmm. sort of rage.
Yeah, you see an anger and a rage born of entitlement. I did not get the white dream. Therefore, I am very angry.
Yeah,
I agree. And I don't... You know, it's been interesting because I'm from the Midwest. I was born in Nebraska. I've lived in the Midwest for about 30 of my 42 years. And so in the wake of the election, when everyone was like, we need to understand... the people in the flyover states, as if it's a great mystery, was particularly interesting to me because it's not a great mystery. We live there. And also this idea that it's white people only. Like, we need to understand white people. We need to understand the working class as if people of color are not part of the working class.
Yeah.
And it's still happening to this day that people are characterizing this in this way. I live in the past 12 years, I've lived in rural Michigan in the Upper Peninsula. I have lived in rural Illinois in Charleston, Illinois, and now I live in central Indiana, which is also rural. And in each of those places, I have seen American poverty up close. And it's a crime. It is appalling. And something needs to be done about it. But what's interesting is that the people who are suffering from this level of poverty think that Black people and Latinos are the ones that are in the way of their economic progress, when in fact it is rich, white, capitalist industrialists that are in their way, and yet they keep supporting them. And I don't know, I think the question isn't how do we understand these people, but rather how do we communicate to them who their true oppressor is? So it's challenging. It's challenging to straddle. The LA thing is very, very new. I've been going back and forth for 3 years for love. And yeah. You know, when it's right, you'll fly 3,000 miles a week. and it's so different. And I love LA. I love it. It's so freeing. I know that people talk about it's all the skinny minis, but it's actually not what you think it is. I mean, that's there, but people in LA are so self-absorbed that they're not worried about you at all. And I love that, but
that's great.
The other great part is that it's so diverse. It's one of the most, and this speaks to the Nebraska in me, that this is new and a revelation, but you see true diversity. Like, every day I see Asian people, which is, in Indiana, you never see Asian people, unless you're on campus, when then 40% of our students are Asian at Purdue. But walking down the street, you just don't see it. And so I'm just like, whoa, what is this? This is heaven. And you see South Asian people and Filipinos and Mexicans and Guatemalans and Hondurans. Like, the diversity is diverse. And I just love that. And so it is very contrasting to go back and forth. But it's also, I think, edifying because it offers a perspective. I'm not going to dismiss the so-called flyover states. I just think we have to change the conversation we're having about it. Another question. Little baby. So cute. I love kids. Yeah.
I can do this without a mic if you want.
Yes, you can.
But I can use the mic as well. Speaking as someone who was raised by a cohort of women whose strategy for surviving the Jim Crow era of the South was to tamp down their anger, how does one get in touch with their anger?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first thing is recognizing and accepting that your anger is justifiable. I think another key thing is that you have to find spaces where you know you can let your anger out. I think one of the challenges that Black people in particular face is that we know that it is not safe to be angry in every space. And so it's also a question of finding the right spaces where you can be angry and where you know you won't lose your life for being angry. That's it. It really is a matter of accepting that anger is okay and then finding a safe place to do it, to be angry, until the world gets safer for all of us. Whenever that is.
We need to all move to LA, I think.
Oh, I don't think it's safe to be angry and Black in LA. Ask Rodney King. That shit did not work out.
This is true.
Yes. Just raise your hand or stand up so she can see you. She's coming. This is a great system. No, I'm kidding. I see the system all the time. It's the best workable situation.
Even as I'm asking this question, I'm thinking maybe you've already answered it in some other setting, but mm-hmm. I love the New York Times interviews with authors where they ask them what they're reading and mm-hmm. what's on their bedside table. And so I'm curious, who are you reading right now, whether nonfiction or if you have time to read?
Yeah.
Or fiction?
Right now I am reading two forthcoming books. One is called An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. And the other book, whose title I'm forgetting, is the one by Ellen Powell, who was the venture capitalist who was had to sue for racial discrimination. It's her memoir. I wouldn't call it a memoir, but it's a book about her experience with that. And so those are the two books I'm reading right now. And they're both forthcoming.
Excellent. Well, I think we're almost done, but I have one last question for
yes.
Roxanne. You have not tweeted for 9 days. I want to know when you're going to start tweeting again, because otherwise I don't want to be on Twitter.
It's funny, I spoke at the Twitter headquarters yesterday.
Is that why you're not tweeting?
No, that's not
you're
why I'm not
like,
tweeting.
You're just like, I hate these people.
I'm just tired of Twitter.
I'm just
tired of it. I love Twitter, but I'm done for now. It's just the constant harassment, the jokes, the you're fat. Fucking I know. You are not giving me new information. And I'm not paid to be there. And so it's a lot of emotional energy for not so much in return. I'm not quitting for good. I'm just taking a little break.
All right. We'll be there when you
All
return.
Right.
We will be there.
Woohoo!
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Roxanne.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.